Iran's parliament overwhelmingly approves a bill aimed at tackling sanctions in what is described as the first practical response to the assassination of a prominent nuclear scientist. A British think tank says nearly 700,000 Britons, including 120,000 kids, have fallen into poverty due to COVID-19. French President Emmanuel Macron says his country won't accept a Brexit deal that does not respect its long-term interests. Hi, this is World News from Tehran. I'm Mehrouz Zatafi. Good to have you with us. Iranian lawmakers have overwhelmingly approved a bill that's aimed at tackling the illegal sanctions imposed on the Islamic Republic. The bill requires the government to produce and store 120 kilos of uranium enriched at a 20% purity level in 2 months. It also calls for making use of advanced centrifuges. Parliament Speaker Mohammad Daghu Ghalibaf says the endorsement sends Iranian enemies the message that a one-sided game has come to an end. Lawmakers pushed for the bill after multiple rounds of U.S. sanctions following its withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018. The bill follows the Friday assassination of eminent Iranian nuclear and defense scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh.
As the people and officials of Iran turned out to pay their respects to the assassinated nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the evidence surrounding the murder began to come to light as more and more clues began to emerge about the circumstances that led up to the killing. Various voices have sent messages of condolences to Iran, as well as to the family and friends of Fakhrizadeh, coupled with strong words of condemnation over the assassination by the likes of the European Union, Hamas, Hezbollah, as well as countries like the United Arab Emirates, China, Jordan, and the UK. Yet again, in circumstances similar to the assassination of Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary or Arbitrary Executions has stated that the assassination of Fakhrizadeh constituted as an extrajudicial killing, suggesting foul play was at the heart of the act. It seems that further evidence has emerged that following the information revealed to Press TV, indications are pointing towards equipment being used in the attack originating from the Israeli regime's arsenal, with senior Iranian officials also stating that the technology used to commit the act was complicated and used remote devices, raising the question as to why the global arena is not calling for this crime to be investigated.
Israelis, they have the capacity and expertise in this. They have done it before. They have assassinated, with the help of the United States, some other Iranian scientists. And they have the motivation. They can gain from this assassination. So there are many reasons to say that Israelis, maybe with the help of Americans, they have done it. Whether other countries, including some of their Arab allies, are also involved in this or not, that's the question. And I think after the investigation and official conclusion, we might be hearing about this from Iranian officials. And according to that conclusion, I think we might be seeing a reaction from Iranian side.
As usual, the Israeli regime has remained eerily silent over the assassination, suggesting by the silence that they have too much to hide, which is not uncommon, as the regime have remained coy on numerous occasions in the past when it comes to the assassination of targets by the Zionist regime. Yet even if the Israelis are not responsible for pulling the trigger, the apparent use of satellite technology to activate the devices used clearly shows some notion of state-sponsored activity and likely sees the Israeli regime's criminal counterparts from the MEK also play a part in the logistics and execution of the act in Iran, something that again bears all the common denominators of a Zionist plot.
Well, Ali Shamkhani, Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, says that remote-controlled equipment were used in that operation. It says no perpetrators were at the scene, accusing the anti-Iran MKO or MEK terrorist organization of having a role in that attack without elaborating. The terrorist attack has pushed the West Asia region to the brink once again. Iranians believe that the Tel Aviv regime and its backer Washington are trying to intensify pressure on Iran in a bid to trigger a full-fledged war.
Tension appears to have risen in the recent weeks following the US elections, especially in parts of West Asia, where traditional allies to the US have started to express concerns that they'll not receive preferential treatment during the next US government's term in office. The emerging evidence that shows the weaponry used in the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh had the hallmarks of Israeli origin suggests that the murder was not solely aimed at stopping the Islamic Republic of Iran pursuing its legitimate and peaceful civilian nuclear program, but was really an act of extreme provocation. A recent meeting in the Saudi region of Neom between Mike Pompeo, Benjamin Netanyahu and Mohammed bin Salman, which has been denied by some, suggests that the planned assassination of Fakhrizadeh was discussed at the meeting, putting the three states on high alert prior to the action. With all three regimes opposed to the Islamic Republic of Iran, the notion of no smoke without fire has never been truer when it comes to this sensitive issue. Was it then the Israeli regime that masterminded the assassination, gaining a nod from its friends along the way? Iran's reaction has been one vowing revenge for the assassination of the esteemed nuclear scientist. Yet, revenge for Iran does not necessarily mean in a like-for-like form of self-defense. For Iran, the most powerful form of revenge could come in the form of a diplomatic card, with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, for one, stating that Iran is far too wise to fall into the trap set by the Zionist regime to provoke Iran into starting a conflict.
I think Iran is in a situation whereby assumes any reaction or response to this assassination inevitable, because if it doesn't respond, it will make the other side to advance further, and that will encourage them to do further assassinations or actions against Iran. But any serious response also might have a risk of let's say chain of actions or reaction which might end in a conflict in the region.
With diplomacy on the table, the most painful strike to the murderous Zionist regime would be showing the world that as a peace-loving nation, the pen is mightier than the sword.
Well, the EU has described the assassination of the Iranian nuclear scientist as a criminal act, but it stopped short of pointing the finger at Israel for that atrocity. One EU lawmaker told Press TV that the murder last Friday was designed to stifle the efforts to pursue diplomacy with Iran. Jerome Hughes has more.
We are told that EU officials are monitoring the situation in the Middle East very closely as tensions escalate over the assassination last Friday of senior Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The 27-nation bloc's foreign policy spokesperson, Peter Stano, gave this reaction when we spoke to him via Skype.
What happened on Friday in the city of Abzaz is a criminal act and runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights on which or for which the European Union is standing for.
One EU lawmaker says Israel orchestrated the attack under false pretenses and in cahoots with the Trump administration to try and scupper Joe Biden's plans to re-engage with Iran in 2021.
People should remember that Iran has no nuclear weapons, despite for the last 25 years Israel crying wolf that they could develop one. Israel has nuclear weapons. So, I mean, which is the bigger danger to peace in the region?
Political commentators say the EU has a pattern of issuing strongly worded statements, but will once again shy away from taking any firm steps against Israel. They say the bloc has turned a blind eye to repeated international law violations perpetrated by Israel and Saudi Arabia. Apparently, this is because the EU does not want to upset the United States, but also trade in weapons and goods to these regimes is worth billions of euro annually. The big question now is, how might Tehran respond to Fakhrizadeh's murder, and what impact could any such response have on ambitions under a Biden presidency to save the Iran nuclear deal? Tehran has always insisted its nuclear energy program is purely peaceful. Security analysts say the Israeli regime and the very powerful Israel lobby in Washington have shown time and time again the last thing in the world they want is peace with Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Time now for the news review. Do stay with us. Welcome to the News Review. Data compiled by a British think tank shows nearly 700,000 Britons have fallen to poverty due to the economic crisis caused by COVID-19. According to a Legatum Institute, an educational charity, 120,000 of those economically hit were children. The coronavirus pandemic will push the number of poor people in the UK to more than 15 million. That accounts for 23% of the total population. The data shows, however, that government relief measure in April prevented another 700,000 Brits from falling into poverty. The study indicates the uneven spread of economic fallout of COVID-19 among different groups, with low-income workers being the most vulnerable. The UK is among the hardest-hit European countries by the pandemic, with more than 58,000 fatalities and 1.6 million infections so far. Now let's get some insight on this and discuss a little bit. So joining me will be our own site, Tour Designer, London Bureau, and also from Brussels we have Paolo Raffone, Secretary General of the SIPPI Foundation. Good to see you both. Welcome to the show. Said, these are horrible statistical figures and numbers in terms of poverty levels in the UK, aren't they?
They certainly are, Beruz, and it's great to be with you as well. As you just said, 120,000 children among the 700,000 estimate by Legatum Institute in the world's sixth largest economy. And it's happening at a time when the government just over the past month announced that it was injecting billions of pounds into the military. So there is money, but apparently it's being spent in different other places, and these children do not seem to be the priority. Organizations and charities involved in providing essentials to the poor, and some of these new people who have fallen into poverty are being referred to as the newly poor, the newly hungry, people who used to have decent incomes but then lost their livelihoods and now are having to rely on food banks. I'll get to that in a minute. So those charities are saying that the government should have a comprehensive anti-poverty strategy at the very heart of its response to COVID-19, and it doesn't seem to be the case just yet. It's not that the government hasn't helped at all. It has. It has given people, for example, a £20 a week handout to try and help them make ends meet. But it has not been adequate, obviously. The hunger crisis is the result of the pandemic, no doubt, but then also the way the government has gone about responding to the pandemic. And so it has hit different groups of people differently, in particular in young people have been hit the hardest, people who work in, for example, the hospitality sector, people who work in retail and entertainment, and low-paid jobs, or people who work zero-hour contracts. So those are the people who have been really hit the hardest. And as I said earlier, these people used to have decent enough incomes, but now they're not able to make ends meet because of the two lockdowns that the government has introduced since the pandemic hit, as well as the oppressive restrictions that it introduced, the tiered system and all that, over the past year. But one more point. Britain's largest food bank network, the Trussell Trust, which has over 1,300 emergency food distribution centers on its network, predicted this 2 months ago when it warned the UK, the government, that the destitution rates in the country would double by Christmas, alongside the explosion in demand for charity food packages. But not much seems to have been done so far.
I see. Okay. Now let's go to Brussels. Paolo, you know, given all the problems that the UK is facing, and it's also, you know, engaged in the final days of talks on the future trade ties with the EU, and the stumbling blocks still remain there. We have the pandemic in place. So will we be forecasting to see more and more Britons get poorer and poorer?
Well, what we see in Britain happening is not only because of the COVID-19. COVID-19 has been a catalyzer of a situation which was just under the surface of the situation in the UK, and not only in the UK. Look at the United States and the rest of the Western countries. They all find extremely difficult to manage a situation which has become socially and economically explosive. And this is the outcome of several decades of neoliberal recipes that have been implemented in all these countries, fragilizing basically the life of a large portion of the society. And so the COVID-19 has just made it explode. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like it is the virus' fault, but the virus has just simply taken off this carpet covering up the surface.
Right. Paolo, what is it that the Boris Johnson administration can do in order to kind of address this issue to the best of their ability?
The only thing is to try to distribute money, helicopter money, to try to reduce the suffering of those people who have been thrown out of the economic cycle because of the pandemic, and probably these people, is not certain they will ever return into any future economic cycle, because we have to be honest, I mean, things will not return exactly as they were.
Okay, I appreciate your comments and contributions. Said Pureza joined me from the London Bureau. I'm Paolo Raffone, Secretary General of the SIPPI Foundation out of Brussels. Thank you for staying tuned. The French president says that Paris won't accept a Brexit deal if it does not respect France's long-term interests. Emmanuel Macron says that France is paying a particular attention to negotiations between the EU and the UK on trade and fishing rights. Now, those comments were made as Britain said that it will continue trade talks with the bloc throughout the week. London saying that the two sides are working hard to bridge their differences. Britain formally left the EU in January, but remains bound by bloc rules until transition period ends by the end of December. The two sides are discussing future relations, but they have remained deadlocked over a number of key issues. The United Nations says that 1 in 33 people around the world will need humanitarian aid next year due to the coronavirus pandemic. The figure will amount to 235 million people. That's a 40% increase from the number of people in need of aid in 2020. The UN says hunger, conflicts, and climate change have made the situation worse. There is also a risk of famine in countries like Syria, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Yemen. The UN is appealing for more funding by wealthier countries. It says it has raised only half of the $35 billion funding required to reach out to those in need. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
The incoming U.S. administration is facing a major test of transparency and ethics after the New York Times reported on Saturday, November 28, that three former government officials tapped to run Joe Biden's national security team have been stakeholders at a private equity firm which is promising investors big profits of government business because of its ties to those officials. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by the staff of Common Dreams website, published under the heading "The Revolving Door: Biden's National Security Nominees Want Back In After Cashing Out of Government Service." Here's the details of this article. The incoming U.S. administration is facing a major test of transparency and ethics after the New York Times reported on Saturday, November 28, that three former government officials tapped to run Joe Biden's national security team have been stakeholders at a private equity firm which is promising investors big profits of government business because of its ties to those officials. Pine Island Capital Partners lists former Under Secretary of Defense Michael Flournoy and retired General Lloyd Austin as DC partners in the firm, and lists former Deputy Secretary of State Tony Blinken as a DC partner on leave of absence. Blinken, together with Flournoy, also founded West Exit Advisors, a strategic advisory firm that doesn't disclose its clients after leaving the Obama administration and ahead of Biden's 2020 campaign. Good government advocates have raised questions about the structure of the organization, which, unlike lobbying shops, does not have to register with the government. Flournoy and Austin are reportedly among the leading candidates being considered for Secretary of Defense, and Blinken is Biden's designated nominee for Secretary of State. Pine Island's chairman is John Tain, the former top executive at Merrill Lynch when the company paid out huge executive bonuses as it began to collapse during the financial crisis. The New York Times reports the consulting firm West Exit Advisors and the investment fund Pine Island Capital Partners call themselves strategic partners and have featured on overlapping roster of politically connected officials, including some of the most prominent names on President-elect Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s team and others under consideration for high-ranking posts. Now, the Biden team's links to these entities are presenting the incoming administration with its first test of transparency and ethics. The two firms are examples of how former officials leverage their expertise, connections, and access on behalf of corporations and other interests without, in some cases, disclosing details about their work, including the names of the clients or what they are paid. And when those officials cycle back into government positions as Democrats affiliated with West Exit and Pine Island are now, they bring with them questions about whether they might favor or give special access to the companies they had worked with in the private sector. Those questions do not go away. Ethics experts say just because the officials cut their ties to their firms and clients, as the Biden transition team says, it nominees will do. West Exit founder include Antony J. Blinken, Mr. Biden's choice to be his Secretary of State, and Michelle A. Flourney, one of the leading candidates to be his Defense Secretary. Among others to come out of West Exit are Avril Haines, Biden's pick to be Director of National Intelligence, Christina Killingsworth, who is helping the president-elect organize his White House budget office, Ely Ratner, who is helping organize the Biden transition at the Pentagon, and Jennifer Psaki, an advisor on Biden's transition team. After the story in the Times, the Daily Poster's David Sirota reported, in Securities and Exchange Commission filings, Pine Island describes one of its investment vehicles as a newly organized blank check company incorporated in Delaware that will use its connections to top officials to take advantage of rising government expenditures on the national security agencies that Flourney and Blinken could oversee. Pine Island's first filings about the investment vehicle were made in September, the same month Biden suggested that he will not push for significant reductions in Pentagon expenditures, which have reached record levels. This is so explicit that it's astonishing Pine Island even put it on the paper, said David Siegel of Demand Progress, a grassroots group pressing Biden to reject cabinet appointments tied to corporations. This is not an example of people who happen to work at a big company. These are partners at a firm whose stated business model is to profit from the revolving door and connections gained from time in government. Flourney would become the first woman to lead the Department of Defense. She represents the epitome of what is worst about the Washington blob, the military-industrial complex revolving door, says Codebeam co-founder Media Benjamin. Her whole history has been one of going in and out of the Pentagon, where she supported every war that the U.S. engaged in and supported increases in military budget. According to an article in the American Prospect titled How Biden's Foreign Policy Team Got Rich, published in July, Flourney could carry her own private practice, but she didn't want a firm with her name on it alone. The trio reached out to defense and intelligence honchos, but with no luck. Then, a particular Washington fixture came to light. He had been Vice President Joe Biden's right-hand man for almost two decades and finished out the Obama administration as Deputy Secretary of State. He was known for his unimpeachable ethics. Having written Biden's speeches for years, he had started to enunciate with Vice President's drawl when he appeared on CNN. He had never cashed in on his international connections, years of FaceTime with Saudi and the Zionist regime leaders. His name was Tony Blinken. With his commitment to join Flourney as a founding partner, a new strategic consultancy was born. They called it West Exit Advisors. West Executive Avenue runs along the west wing of the White House, the connection between presidential power and the offices where aides sit and do their real work. The name West Exit Advisors trades on its founder's recent knowledge of the highest echelons of decision-making. It also suggests they will be walking down the West Exit toward 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue someday soon. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Dispossession, the great social housing swindle directed by Paul Sung. And joining me in this episode are Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and many other outlets. And beside him is Claudia Webb, who is a Labour Party councillor in the London Borough of Islington. Now, Dispossession is a documentary that explores the catastrophic failures by successive governments that have led to a chronic shortage of social housing in Britain. The film focuses on the neglect, demolition and regeneration of council estates across the UK and investigates how the state works with the private sector to demolish council estates to build the land they stand on, making properties that are unaffordable to the majority of people.
They're going to regenerate it, which means total demolition. And when it very first started, it was a case of nothing will happen without your approval. Well, that was lie number one on day one, and it's never changed.
We've got councils of all kinds across London who are trying to demolish traditional council estates. They're actually destroying communities.
It was Mrs. Thatcher whose right to buy scheme was a vote winner for families like the Pattersons. She gave them the title deeds to their council house. They gave her tea in return.
Don't you think this is lovely?
The right to buy was probably the most popular policy ever introduced by Conservative government.
Housing is a fundamental human need, and it's one that the market just doesn't seem to be capable of providing.
We should be building every year about 240,000, 250,000 homes, and we're nowhere near that.
I want there to be no hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
Essentially, we've had successive governments that simply haven't seen the role for social housing, and they've been cutting it.
It's not seen as being aspirational, and aspiration is the key word.
The last 10, 20 years, housing stock that used to be here is down, it's gone.
Access to housing in Glasgow, to social housing, is nigh on impossible.
They are tearing apart our community, brick by brick, and we're not going to let them!
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a very serious problem facing this country, and it was a very moving and deeply personal documentary for the director, I believe, as he grew up on a council estate. And especially in the wake of the Grenfell Tower tragedy, this film comes at a very important time. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I was very impressed by it. I thought the first time I saw this film, I was a little bit concerned about how compacted it was, the amount of information it crams into an hour and, I think, 26 minutes. The second time I saw it, I was impressed by the amount of information that it did get in, the amount of ground that it covers, the fact that it covers all these issues from so many different angles. I mean, you're getting the input of the politicians who have to make the policy decisions that cause estates to be built or to be knocked down. Mm-hmm. You're also getting the input from people on the ground, residents of the estates, who have a very different take on it. So, I'm a big fan of this film.
So, as you say, this documentary, it was very dense, packed with information, statistics, and usually these films are quite difficult to watch. So do you think the director was successful in conveying his message then?
Yes, because in part I think that it makes its points pictorially. I mean, it is very crisply shot, and it's one of the situations where I think if we're walking down a street anywhere, this is the kind of issue that hits you smack in the face. You know, we could go for a walk around the studios here and we would see 3, 4, 5 luxury flat developments springing up everywhere, but we'd probably see more homeless people than we'd see social housing developments going up. And the film is very acutely attuned to what is actually happening at street level, and it shows you the disrepair that many estates have fallen into, and it contrasts that with the slightly sort of eerie gloom of these new developments going up that don't seem to be inhabited by anyone because no one's got the money to afford to move in there.
And Claudia, if I could turn to you now, as someone who works closely with this issue, is the social housing crisis in this country as bad as the documentary suggests it is?
Well, the documentary highlights quite well, actually, the state of play of council housing and council house in the UK, and in particular, actually, in London, and the sort of the dilemma that is, that councils face as against the sort of the notion of community, the notion of identity, and the notion of neighbourhood, the concept of fairness. Right at the very heart of an urban inner city area, and what does a home mean? And it begins to explore what that means today, as against what it should have meant. And what we've got really in terms of what the documentary is portraying and what the film is portraying is this whole issue of, you know, council homes being sold off for profit. Council land being sold off for profit, and exposing really a reality and dichotomy of huge waiting lists, homelessness, and yet council homes being sold off for profit against that sort of waiting list, and then what happens to communities and what happens to neighbourhoods. It's a stark contrast, and the film has really brought home and brought out the realities of the dangers of making the wrong decisions.
Indeed, and this documentary, one of the key messages is that a home is a right and not a privilege.
We need to offer housing to people at lower rates than full market cost. And the way historically we've done that is we've built social housing. We've provided housing to people that the state has some direct investment in, on the premise that not everybody can afford to rent at full market cost, or indeed afford to purchase their own home.
The current government has slashed investment in social housing so much that the housing crisis can only get worse. The only solution is to invest in social housing again, both through local authorities to build council homes and through housing associations to build social homes, in the way that the post-war government invested. And they need to be homes that people can afford, not homes that are called affordable, which are not.
If you build a council estate and people move in, those people pay rent to the local authority. After a few years, then the cost of building has paid for itself. Whereas if you have private rent, A, it's a lot more expensive, B, that money goes straight into landlords' pockets and doesn't get reinvested. It's a really good economic model, and it also points to the fact that housing should be a right for everybody.
In this documentary, we learn there's various misconceptions about social housing. Claudia, if I could ask you, why is there a need for social housing?
Well, social housing is really relevant in a local area where people, in a sense, can't afford to live in a home unless housing is provided that meets their ability to pay for that home. And in a sense, what we've got is a growing population and basic need. And a basic need is a roof over your head. And if councils are deprived from building homes, then in a sense what you've got is demand outstripping supply. And really what the documentary highlighted by showing clips of Margaret Thatcher, it highlights Thatcherism and the policies of Thatcherism, which at the time
was the right to buy scheme.
Which was one, the issue about right to buy, but two, under Thatcherism, they stopped councils from building council homes. Councils used to be a machine for council homes. So within local authorities, you not only saw the production of homes, but you also saw the architects, the builders, the quantity surveyors, all of the professional skill sets located within a council. Those skill sets have long gone.
And thank you for that point and shedding light on the need for social housing. And Mike, if I can turn to you now, we learned from the film that there are various stigmatisms about social housing. What are they? What are some of these stigmatisms?
Well, one of the issues that the film addresses very well is the recent rise of TV shows like Benefit Street and things like that, where people who live on housing estates are, you know, it's these places are called sink estates, and you know there's a certain stigma that goes with that. But there's a portrayal of people who live on estates as feckless and, you know, alcoholic and, you know, someone...
Scroungers.
Exactly. That's the kind of show. And these shows are very cheap to produce, like all reality TV, very cheap to produce, can get syndicated and make a TV channel or production company lots of money. What they actually give back to a society, a country, a community, is very little. It's, you know, to stigmatise the people who appear on these shows and people who live on council estates in general. And I think part of that is that because these shows are made by people from outside those communities looking in. And it's often, as the film suggests, people who actually live on council estates, they have a community, they have a life there, they know where they're going, they know, you know, where their house relates to other people, the people who live next door to them. And it's not a sink estate. It's they're not circling the plug hole. You know, they're getting by. These places are functional, but they're being depicted in such a way as to suggest that they're not, and they need knocking down.
I'm going to continue this discussion in the next part.
I want there to be no hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
In his first public speech following Labour's landslide victory in 1997's general election, Tony Blair stood on the Aylesbury estate in South East London and vowed there would be no forgotten people in the Britain his party wanted to build. 20 years later, residents of the Aylesbury might wonder what happened to New Labour's bold vision of the future. Since 2001, campaigners have fought against Southwark Council's plans to regenerate the estate. The council argued that the Aylesbury needs to be demolished due to the high cost of essential repairs. Campaigners claim that the council allowed the estate to deteriorate in order to facilitate its demise and justify a £1.5 billion redevelopment project.
So we saw Tony Blair there. And Claudia, I have to ask you, why didn't Blair fulfil his promises?
Well, I mean, I think the reality is that when, in 1997, Labour came into power in the aftermath of Thatcherism, in the aftermath of councils not being invested in to build council housing. And, you know, one could have wished and hoped that the new policy of Labour would have been to enable councils to build council homes again. A good council will build good quality homes, and with the resources and the investment will invest in the stock that it has. But equally, if designs aren't right, and you know, designs for their time aren't always fit for the future, and you then need to think about how do you make that housing stock work? How do you make it livable and continue to be enjoyable? But equally, what's important is, and what I fundamentally believe in, is if you are going to regenerate an estate, then what you need to bring back is council housing. You regenerate the estate to create continued council homes, and that we shouldn't need to, as councils, go into business with the private sector and sell off the land and sell off the homes for profit. And that's what councils need investment, so they don't have to do that. Maybe that they weren't presented with was the investment that was necessary to rebuild council homes rather than engage in a partnership with the private sector.
So you're saying that the Labour Party, the New Labour back then, effectively inherited this crisis. But Mike, from the documentary I get the sense that the Conservative Party are much to blame, but do Labour share as much blame also?
Well, one of the strengths of the film is that it recognises that this is essentially a non-partisan issue. You know, everyone, whether you're of the right or of the left, needs a roof above your head. And I think it recognises, as much as, you know, Labour and the Conservatives like to play this fun game on Question Time of blaming one another for previous policies, there is a degree to which both parties are to blame, and this is why we're in the situation that we're in now. But yes, that right to buy scheme was, although a huge success at the time, has proven to have taken so many properties out of the public sphere and put them in private hands. But I think at the same time, the film says that, you know, when Tony Blair did come into power, not enough was done to counteract that policy. It was seen as such as a sort of overwhelming success. What can you do? You know, well, you could build more houses, and I think that was one of the issues that leads to the situation that we're in right now, that we simply don't have enough houses for the people who need them.
And another, I want to talk about a different aspect of the documentary now. And one of the effects of the housing crisis seems to be the dismantling of the sense of community. I get this sense from the documentary that the film suggests that there were outside parties that were directly targeting and sort of dividing the community in order to conquer it. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is... In some ways, what the film is talking about is the direction of the entire nation over the past 50 years. I mean, we're told very early on that a lot of social housing was built close to factories, close to industries. And of course, once those industries closed down in the 60s, 70s, 80s, the last decade or so, where do the people who live on those estates go now? You know, how do they pay their rent? And if they can't pay their rents, does someone come in and take their property away from them? So that it's raising bigger questions than just questions around housing. It's about, you know, who, you know, how much responsibility do councils have for the people who live in within their remit?
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll just have to pause there again just for now. I'll let you get back to that point, Claudia.
As the estate falls into decay, I believe it was a deliberate strategy of the local authority because they saw the Elephant Castle at the time as a prime market for real estate.
I haven't got all the details on the Hagett, but my understanding is that some of the social rented properties will be built in another part of the borough. But again, it's around the fact that if we are going to take down a certain number of social rented properties, it's about making sure we're re-providing that, actually re-providing more for the same level of rent.
For the demolition of 9,000 plus council homes, and their replacement with luxury apartments costing £600,000 and £700,000 as an entry price, was their answer to the problem. That's no answer to the 9,000, 10,000 tenants that were living in secure accommodation at the time that are now dispersed across London, and many dispersed outside of London.
People who benefit from the housing crisis are, of course, property developers. They want to have the densest housing possible. And the best way to make dense housing is to build luxury apartments and to make it look like, you know, you're building a tall tower block, not to house many families as they did in the 60s and 70s, but to give a really slick community lifestyle.
Now, before we went to that clip, we were just talking about the notion of dismantling of the community by the outside parties. Claudia, did you agree with what Mike said?
Well, I mean, I have a different take on it because obviously we're in, my context is London, and I can see that in areas like Newark, in Nuneaton, for example, which had a coal industry, that if you create homes around a particular industry and then that industry disappears in terms of the mining industry, then you are left with homes and people without access to meaningful work. That's not the case in London. What you've got in London is a total land grab. It's a disgrace, really, in terms of a total land grab by big developers who are basically capitalising on the opportunity that is presented by the lack of inability of councils to build and invest in homes. The policy of not allowing councils to build homes, that is what's been problematic, because it's been over decades and not over a few years. What we have now in places like my own borough, where we have a good council that is building good quality homes, we bucked the trend and we sought to build council homes, and we sought to find ways to do that and ensure that we do not sell off council land. But where we have planning, where we give planning permissions to the developers where they've got their own private land, what unfortunately has been created historically over time is the notion of poor doors. We have a policy of 50% of that must be affordable, meaning, you know, social rent properties. And what they do is they build that what integral to the development, but they build it on the side or at the back, and that's where the creation of poor doors happens.
Of course,
it's
you're in Jeremy Corbyn's borough, and he's pledged to end the housing crisis. But I want to talk about this notion now in the film of social cleansing, which seems to be a contentious, controversial term, which means that low-income workers are being driven out of the capital London because of the soaring rents and the interest of corporations, of course, and real estate agents. What do we learn in the film about this?
The film's very good on gentrification and how neighbourhoods have changed rapidly over the last 10, 15, 20 years. So, you know, social housing is of less concern than attracting middle-class renters with lots of disposable income who can afford coffee and hummus and all the treats of living in the inner cities. But you know, there is a degree to which housing policy seems to have been skewed specifically, almost exclusively, towards that particular demographic. And of course, that drives out people who are originally living there, and you know, that's one of the many big issues that this film addressed.
Well, part of that was the huge banking crisis that happened. You know, what happened after the banking crisis was in London, then. London's property market was then used as the place where people invest. And so what you've got is overseas investors purchasing land and property, never ever living in those properties and creating a this and them scenarios and situations. What is a disgrace is when it's set against that. So you've already got that as a problem going on. Set against that is when councils have got land and homes in council control. What is a disgrace is councils then selling that off in some kind of partnership with the private sector.
It is such a complex issue.
It is.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time in this programme. And just final 30 seconds to Mike. Would you recommend this documentary?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're now in a situation where the Evening Standard can run a front page about house prices going up as though that's some great triumph. To me, it looks more and more like a tragedy, and this film absolutely reflects that.
Well, thank you very much for your time and joining the show. And I'm afraid that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.